We have the tech to get food delivered in 15 minutes, but we all have horror stories about buying tickets. The Game Time app gives fans the advantage. Get amazing tickets in just a few taps. Fees are included, so what you see is what you pay. And the Game Time guarantee means authentic tickets at the best price every time. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets to concerts, sports, comedy, and more with Game Time. Download the Game Time app and create an account for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply.
Let's call it Book Week at BPIB. A brand new episode of the best podcast in baseball features longtime baseball writer, former president of the Baseball Writers Association, and both a beat writer and a columnist there in New York. It's author Ken Davidoff, who is the co-author of a book, 101 Lessons from the Dugout. It's a merger of baseball, parenting tips, and life lessons for kids. We talk about that book, the lessons that can be drawn from the dugout, but also from the mound and the base paths and the batter's box, and we dive into the labor negotiations. When last I saw Ken on the beat, we were covering the previous CBA negotiations, standing outside the Cardinals Jupiter Complex, watching officials and players go back and forth and waiting for a deadline that never came. The podcast starts with me trying to say 101 and saying 101, 100, and for all types of things. Cue the music. I can do better than this. All right, let me do this. All right, that's why I said it that way.
Well, you can say that. It's either 101 or 101, 101.
Well, that
they're all acceptable.
Shoot, that was bad. Usually I nail it. One take, Tony. Anyway. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by a longtime friend, longtime baseball writer, a guy who was, let's say, in the room where it happens when we were having some of these CBA talks with both the commissioner's office and the union. It is, of course, Ken Davidoff, now an author of the book, 101 Lessons from the Dugout. Ken, thank you so much for joining me. This is great. I'm eager to talk to you, eager to catch up with you, and we get to record it and share it with people.
Yeah, Derek, thanks for having me on the podcast, and it's great to see you.
You and, good to see you too. You and your co-author, Harley A. Rotbart, have taken this book, 101 Lessons from the Dugout, and basically, if I set the premise right, is that it's, here are things that happen on the baseball field that you can relate to real life. Some of them are lessons, as you say in the title. Some of them are affirmations, though, too, throughout the book. What when you're starting on the book, do you have ideas of the lessons you want to share, or do you have ideas of the parts of the baseball game you want to turn into larger lessons?
So, Derek, I think you know me well enough. I'm a full disclosure type of person. So, full disclosure, my co-author, Harley Rotbart, this is his baby. Harley is a longtime parenting expert. He is a now retired pediatrician. So he came up with the idea of, like, you know, and he would use it to help his own patients, his own young patients. Like you love playing baseball. You love playing softball. Now let's take what you've learned from those experiences and apply it to the rest of your life to help you with the rest of your life. So in terms of how this book was actually created, I'm going to share a little secret with you. Harley came up with all 101 chapters.
Okay.
Like he wrote the first draft of this book. And then Harley and I had the same literary agent, Lisa Leshny, and Lisa paired us up. And Harley said, Ken, why don't you be my co-author and, like, look at my draft and roll up your sleeves and get in there, you know, like kind of infuse the book with your knowledge. You know, Harley had the grassroots knowledge of having coached kids in baseball and softball and having interacted with young people. And then he said, you've covered the game at the highest level, so why don't you kind of, you know, add your perspective to that? And then the other component is, you know, my connections, you know, people like you, Derek. And then like the foreword of the book is written by legendary New York Met David Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have endorsements from Reggie Jackson, from Bernie Williams, former St. Louis Cardinal Joe Girardi,
sure,
and a few other folks.
Yeah, Joe Girardi, a former Cardinal, but also kind of beloved for his role with the Cubs, which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Beloved Cubs just because.
Illinois native.
Yes, Illinois native, and I've often fielded earlier in my career questions as to why is he not managing the Cardinals. I remember those days. he was doing okay in pinstripes, if I remember correctly, at the time. You know, it's interesting. Like, I wondered about, like, for you, how much of working on this book then was looking back on covering baseball, or gave you a chance to look back on maybe why you were so fond of baseball, because you do kind of really pick apart every part of the game.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Derek. And this book, for me personally, came at the perfect time. And I know you and I have discussed this. You know, I quit 4 years ago. Like, I left the industry for all intents and purposes. You know, I was with the New York Post as a baseball columnist. I've been doing it full time for about 25 years. And I said, I'm out. Like, I was just burned out. You know, I couldn't write one more column about, you know, why have the Yankees lost 5 of 7, or, you know, what trades do the Mets need to make, you know, and covering MLB is a huge entity. I the labor talks, as you mentioned, like, yeah. I just got burned out by all of it. So then to be approached with this book, where the book is just, you're embracing your love of the game and all its incredible elements and the fundamentals of it. And there's no doubt I had lost my love of that game, some by choice, because I feel like in order to cover it right, you can't care about the consequences, right? Like, if you write about labor or anything, or a gambling scandal, you really can't care if, oh, you're Derek Gould, that column hurt baseball. I don't care. My job is to serve journalism, right? Mm-hmm. Like, not help baseball. But now to put that aside and say, okay, this is why I love the game and why I did love my job for the overwhelming majority of the time that I did it.
Yeah, it's interesting, is like, when I was looking at the book, I probably was looking at it through the lens of, like you talked about, like parenting, right? Like, here are some things for kids. But just right there in what you were describing, it's like, oh man, some of those lessons that you were talking about there, like, you have to care about your goal. You know, you have to care about, like, your assignment, your position. There are lessons in here for adults that are applicable to, like, even the situation you described with leaving baseball writing.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And I'll share one of my favorite lessons, just to give your listeners a taste. Yeah. And my favorite lesson, this book is written in a vernacular for young people, Derek. I mean, it's classified as young adult nonfiction. I think from a technical standpoint, it's ages 12 and up. But chapter 38, tagging up, pause and control your anger.
And all right, this is the one that I wrote down, which is
wild. Funny. Okay. Yeah. So Harley, my co-author, came up with a correlation between, you know, like, when you first start playing the game, you're on third base, standing on third base for less than 2 outs. You know, what do you do when the ball is hit? Run, right? The ball is hit to the outfield, run. But of course, you learn over time, like, no, pause, tag up, and wait, see if the ball's caught, then tag third base and come home. And the idea that, like, how many times in life we just have this instinct to react, you know, rather than taking that moment to, quote unquote, tag up, you know, and pause and take a deep breath. Okay, now let's react to the situation. You know, as a 55-year-old, there are still far too many times when I don't tag up, metaphorically speaking, and perhaps you witnessed some of those in some of our discussions in the room where it happened. Yeah, like, I think that lesson in particular applies to players of all ages.
I'm all right being the one that tags up. Like, in those discussions, I was all right being the one that, like, whoa, I'm going to – there were a lot of big personalities. Ken was a long time – well, former – I guess no one's a long time president of
baseball, right? So right? One-year term.
Except for me, I got 14 months of it, man. So I guess I qualify as a long time because they had the added 2 months. But you were president of the Baseball Writers Association, but president, like I was, during a CBA.
Yeah.
And so part of that, when I say in the room where it happens, part of that is we have to have these discussions about access and media policies and everything, which are included in the CBA. And I'll get to that. I will ask you not about media policies necessarily, but about the CBA, but I really wanted to, like, look first at this book, because it's fascinating to me that the one that you shared is the one that, like, I was really struck by. As I'm reading through the book, I'm like, oh, this is like the perfect Venn diagram of where, like, watching a baseball game and having an argument or having a decision or having an action come in, and it's this gather yourself moment. Observe, you know, it is okay if someone is coming at you in a parking lot, or if someone is really or if someone is really rude and yelling at you, it is okay to gather yourself, to pause, because it might, you know, diffuse the situation. Or if you have a test and you feel like things are racing, I really like that application too. It's okay to pause. Sometimes like a 5 second pause means you'll be 5 minutes faster. And I like that notion that there's a lot of imagery in this book that I think fits, right? If we know baseball and, or you're a baseball fan, I think that's part of the power of it, is it gives you the imagery that then passes along a lesson, and it applies to so many things. This was just one example. Another one that really struck me was the mound, right? Mm. Where you're talking about the pitcher on the mound, obviously, is the center of the action, the creator, the one that gets things going. And the power that that gives the pitcher, the attention that that gives the pitcher. And then the lesson there is, when you take the mound with something you believe in, you know, what that means. Could you elaborate on that notion, that like that image of the spotlight is on the mound, and if you believe in something, that is your mound?
Yeah, thank you, Derek. So just to give your listeners a better picture of the book, so each of these 101 chapters is one or two pages, and so just quick bites, and we have divided it into six parts. So part one is in the dugout, okay. Part two at the plate, part three on base, part four in the field, part five on the mound, and part six extra innings. So part five on the mound opens up with the chapter you're referencing, chapter 59, the mound. Stand up for what you believe. Pick your battles carefully. And yeah, exactly. And I remember when CC Sabathia, he got injured in the 2019 AL Championship Series, and he was already announced his retirement. So like he was done. He had thrown his last pitch. And he was just kind of, and he held like a press conference the next day, and he was just kind of waxing poetic about why he loved the pitch. And he, you know, he said, bleep don't happen until I decide I'm ready. You know, so he, you know, just the power that comes with that of standing on the mound. So I'll, you know, and then the idea of translating that over to the rest of your life, like to have that situations where you do have that kind of control. So I'll quote from the book. Your mound should be saved for the times you really need it. If you take a strong stand for every opinion or idea you have, or every time you disagree with someone, people won't take you seriously when something comes up that is truly important to you. Pick your battles carefully. Don't risk being seen as a nag or a pest. Then when you step and fire your best stuff, people will listen.
It also refers to the mound as the high ground, which I thought was interesting. You know, not just a notion of, you know, like when you're going to instigate something, do so carefully, but this notion that you're coming from a top something, that you did, if you are going to be there, make sure you have the high ground before you ever step on it.
Yeah Find a high ground to deliver your best stuff. Send your message loud and clear with force, and stay strong. Know what you stand for and stand tall for it.
It's really good. There's a part then later on, as you kind of work your way through the book, that I also think was going to be good for baseball writers to read for sure. And it's about relief pitching and the notion that there are no win situations. I don't know if we actually think of relief appearances and no win situations, but we probably should in a lot of ways. Yeah. Because if they do well, they did their job. If they do poorly, a lot of times it's, you know, I was actually talking with veteran reliever Ryan Stanek about this. And we were talking about how when you're in the job of a baseball writer, if you don't introduce yourself to a reliever until April 23rd, when they blew a 3-run lead, and you've had all of spring training and the first few weeks of the season, and you've not talked to this person until they failed, meaning you also didn't talk to them as they made the team, as they pitched well in spring, as they had, you know, did their job for 3 weeks of the season. He said that, he goes, relievers realize that. They know that. Yeah. And I was like, it's very true. And baseball writers should recognize that. You learn that pretty early on. you know, but there, this notion of relief as a no-win situation, I thought was really interesting and a new perspective. But that, but it, in the book, you talk about that being like how you can be draw positive from that, right?
Yeah. I mean, and again, I'll read from the book, and I think you nailed the synopsis of it. But you know, you may be called in for relief off the field too. One of the actors in the school play or one of the musicians in the school band gets sick, and you're the backup. Even though you weren't the first choice for the play or the band, you should practice and prepare as if you have the starting role. So if the time comes and you're called in, you'll be ready. Or maybe one of your classmates working with you on a group project can't do their share of the work, but the project is due soon. So asking you to be a reliever on the field or off means people had faith you might be able to pull one out. If you can't, you may feel like you let everyone down, but really you entered into a very difficult no-win situation. Most importantly, don't be shaken or rattled. You'll be called into one of life's games again, and you've got to believe in yourself so the next time you may beat the odds and win the no-win situation.
I think it's really interesting. I like that, just the framing. I also read it and was like, oh, this, it could be a way we actually talk about relief pitching a little bit differently.
Yeah.
It also struck me in hearing you tell how you got involved in the book that this applies to you, that you came in and somewhat as a pinch hitter to write the book.
Oh, the book?
Yeah.
Interesting. I had never thought of it that way. But I mean, yeah, I would say, look, again, some chapters apply better to players of all ages than others, right?
Yeah.
Like this chapter, yeah, look, if a guy, you know, Edwin Diaz is getting, $20 million or whatever he got from the Dodgers, I think the bar is raised a little more.
So, absolutely.
And yeah. I think, you know, when I entered into this book project, the idea was like, you know, Ken, it's your job, you know, in addition to helping rewrite this book, like it's your job to kind of get the word out. So like,
I was thinking about it going, oh, he's going along and some of these lessons are actually applicable to while he's working on this book as well.
Very meta.
What was when you were talking with Arlie as co-authors, what was kind of the tone that you wanted to strike with this book?
That's a really good question. So I think we wanted to, it was a balance between kid friendly but also grounded, you know. And so I think my job was to, in many ways, was to ground it. You know, like, okay, like, was just trying to think of an example. We have a chapter on uniforms early on. Mm-hmm. I think it's a chapter. Oh, it's chapter 7 or it's early on. So, and just kind of talking through that chapter. Oh, chapter 5, the uniforms, standing out, blending in, acting cool. Mm-hmm. And trying to, you know, so what we're trying to, the lesson we're trying to stress there is, you know, be a team player, right? Like, don't, you know, don't try to stand out too much so that you're a distraction, like even just with the way you put on your uniform, you know. Mm-hmm. And but I said, like, oh, Harley, you know, there are times when it's okay. Let's say, you know, think of the time, all the games you've covered, like a player put a little message on his hat for a relative who was sick or something like that, or just something a little unique like that. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, can we preserve the message while just kind of grounding it a little bit and adding these nuances. So we do have something in there about, you know, kind of voicing that sentiment. You know, some fun with uniforms can be a good thing, but only if everyone on the team, including the coach, is in on it. Differently colored shoelaces on your cleats or little messages on your caps that are unique to you, but part of a team scheme, can strengthen team spirit while still letting you express yourself as an individual.
So yeah, like personality.
Was,
yeah.
Yeah. Like that was that was a Ken line, you know? So, but just little nuances like that.
Yeah. Personality can exist in conformity. Like there's a blend.
Yeah, exactly.
Also early on in the book, there's a discussion about pinch runners and pinch hitters. And this
I like that one a lot.
And there's this idea, it really expands upon the notion of pinch runners and pinch hitters to the idea that not everybody has the same skills. Mm-hmm. Everybody on a baseball field may want the same thing, and that is playing time and performance. Not everybody has the same skills. And I thought it was really interesting how you described at the end of a game, though, everybody has a familiar feeling that they wish everybody was involved in it. And there are a lot of youth teams, as you mentioned in the book, where there will be more people in the dugout, high school teams, where there'll be more people in the dugout, more people who don't play than do play, just by the nature of math. But they can still contribute, be it a pinch hitter, pinch runner. And then you take that next leap, not just about like, well, this guy may be the fastest, this may be the best fielder, and they can still contribute in these ways. You take that the next leap to the notion of inclusion. Could you kind of take the listeners through that path a little bit about how it goes from this baseball idea of contributing skills to a win to the notion of embracing others just for their differences?
Yeah, thank you, Derek. So this is chapter 7, pinch hitters and pinch runners, include others, speak up for friends. And in my mind, this is a companion chapter to chapter 2, the starting lineup, prove you're ready, earn your spot, believe in yourself. Chapter 2 just introduces the scenario. All right, you come to the field and you're not in the lineup. Like, how are you going to react to that? You know, and obviously the goal should be to stay strong and try to be the best pinch hitter, pinch runner, defensive replacement you can be, and translate that to the rest of your life. Whenever you face a disappointment, you know, how to approach that. So then chapter 7 approaches the same scenario from the flip side. You know, let's look at it from the ones who are in the starting lineup. Mm-hmm. Like, how can you help those who didn't get in there? So as you include others, speak up for friends. And, you know, you see it, I think that's one that is for players of all ages. You know, think of those championship teams that you've covered, Derek, where, you know, an Albert Pujols or Scott Rowland was gone by 11, right? So, but whoever else was on that.
But he was 06.
Yadi Molina, or Rowland in 06, right? So, how they made sure everyone felt like part of that team, mm-hmm. Those championship teams. And then for sure, I think that can translate to any walk of life. So to quote from the book, and maybe tempting to follow the cool crowd who find you worthy, but enjoy keeping others out. Don't join them. Speak up for the outsiders and consider whether you really want to be a part of a crowd that acts that way to your other friends. The same group may change its mind about you someday. Every game can use a pinch runner or a pinch hitter. And every player off the bench becomes part of the team effort, making everyone stronger and raising the spirit in the dugout.
Yeah, I mean, that's applicable. I mean, you mentioned that 2011 team. That idea of, like, contribution, different roles people could play, how it takes everybody to be involved, but only if they know they can be involved. You know, I mean, we're in the press box covering the NLCS of 2011, and one of the highlights of my career was covering the playoffs with this group of baseball writers that was Bernie Miklas, Brian Burwell, the two columnists, Joe Strauss, Rick Hummel, the baseball writer, the five of us.
Team.
Yeah, that was the five of us covering
baseball
together. It was awesome. And we all had different skills. We all had different personalities. We knew where we fit and how they fit together.
Perfect.
Strauss and I spent so much time working together. We definitely knew where our strengths helped each other. And I say this just because, you know, one of the assignments was getting a column in early. Burwell took that. So mm-hmm. he did the early. Mm-hmm. And then, you know what he did for us afterwards when we were all on deadline? He ran quotes.
Wow.
Because he's like, I can go to the other side, or I can go get this. I can have quotes ready for these guys. I can get stuff. So if this game goes into extra innings, their stuff, you know, that is available to the guys who have to write in 5 minutes, was just remarkable. So, I thought that was a very powerful chapter because it took beyond the notion of not just like everybody has different skills, but the importance of a whole team celebrating those different skills.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, I was also blessed with the New York Post.
Absolutely.
Joel Sherman and George King and Mike Puma and Dan Martin and Mike Vaccaro. And there was such a team ethic there, similar to Burwell running quotes, like, whatever you guys need, we're all thinking of each other collectively as a group, not like I got to finish my column. you know, but like, yeah, what do you need? What do you need? I'll get, you know, here's something that can help you. And it was just a great team environment.
Yeah. And that was wild when we rumbled in the 06 NLCS. You guys had the numbers, but we were the scrappy Midwesterns.
No, I'm kidding. It's funny. I didn't cover. Yeah. You know, I covered.
I'm kidding.
06. I was with Newsday, also a great group. But I covered. I covered Tigers, A's, you know, while the Mets were with it. I was preparing for the Mets World Series. It never happened.
That's why the Post lost to us. They didn't have you yet. See, they needed you to come. I do want to talk about the current game, and I'll just begin by, 06 is a good kind of entry point because I just have, like, I'll just start with this question. Mets? What's up? Why can't they stop being the Mets? Why are the Mets always the Mets?
It's amazing, Derek, because I think when the Wolpon sold the team to Steve Cohen after the 2020 season, the expectation would be, okay, new universe. The Mets are no longer the Mets, and the Mets are still very much the Mets in year six of Cohen's ownership, and it's just crazy. And I think the world of David Stearns. I mean, you got to cover those, you know, a lot of those Brewers teams that he put together. And I, you know, if you and I have been talking 3 years ago, and I said, oh, well, you know, David Stearns is going to take over the Mets, he's going to fix them. And he hasn't, obviously. And I do wonder whether they just accounted, David and his group accounted enough for the New York factor. You know, I think it's different. I do. And I don't know how, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Like New York, Boston, Philly, those three cities in particular, I think are much, much harder to play in than the other major league cities. And you're seeing Bo Bichette really scuffle. Mm-hmm. And then a bunch of guys getting hurt. Injury prone guys getting hurt, I should stress. So that hasn't been great. But they are just a big hot mess. And, you know, they're on pace to go down as the biggest flop in the history of Major League Baseball.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think I do agree with you about the markets for different reasons. Philly is combative and feisty. Mm.
Yeah.
And that goes for both the fans and the media, I think, in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very much cross-examination from both of them. Yeah. And it can be tough. It can wear on somebody. It can also invigorate people. It depends on the personality. I mean, I think what Bryce Harper has done there to become Philadelphia is remarkable. You know, I talked with Ryan Howard for a long time when he was about what it was like and how, you know, there's just like there's just a real feistiness to Philly. There's just a real suffocation to New York that players have to get used to.
Yeah. The volume of media.
Yeah. And then the back page mentality, which, you know, well, I mean, that doesn't exist anywhere else anymore. It used to, in Chicago with the Sun-Times, there used to be somewhat of a back page mentality, but the fact that your name could be turned into a pun that is used against you, I mean, that's a whole different world.
Yeah.
Boston and I would argue that St. Louis probably a little bit similar, though maybe St. Louis has lost this element this year. But players have told me that, like, coming to St. Louis, where they're the game in town, that is a different element than other places where every bit of media, every bit of attention in town is on them, and where it might be Midwest nice and everything like that.
Right.
It is to a point, as long as you're winning. And then if you're not, like I've had players say that they come to St. Louis and they were like really on their heels right from the start when they were asked about, like, okay, well, what, like, how do you help the team win the World Series? No, what? Like, no, that's the bar here. Like, that's how do you win the World Series? And if they'd come from other places, you know, that can, and some guys don't thrive here because of that.
Yeah.
They were like, okay, well, I had this really great week or month and everything like that, and all you guys are asking me is, like, what does that mean for October? That doesn't make any sense to me. Boston has some of that too, but it's cranked up, you know. It's bigger market and bigger market.
Yeah.
So I do think there's something to that. I just am fascinated by how the Mets can't stop being the Mets. Like, as much as I see them in spring training, it's like, what, like, I can see how, like, you could be better in these areas or you could focus on this stuff. What stops you from it? It's just, it's gotta be in the water or something. You know, it's just, it's weird. What do you make of kind of the competition? The Mets are part of a National League that is just super robust. The American League has the New York Yankees and the Rays. The Rays are playing well. But really, otherwise, it's wide open slash not good. You know, what do you make of kind of what the National League has become?
Yeah, it's really become such a force, right? I mean, and it's really, it's exciting to see the Braves back being the Braves. You know, that was, you know, certainly a little bit of a surprise. And then the Brewers are just ridiculous what they do year after year, you know, trading away Peralta and, you know, just shrug it off, and the Dodgers are the Dodgers. And yeah, it's just nice. I mean, I'm looking at the NL Central now, all five teams still with winning records, including the Cardinals that you cover. Really, really cool. And the Padres are just, so, you know, you're talking about a feisty organization, right? I mean, what they do is remarkable. The Diamondbacks are just like a model of competence, you know, like they're always in the mix. And the Phillies have woken up after the manager firing, and even the Nats are 31-31 with a huge offense. So so it's really, I can't remember the league imbalance ever being this pronounced. That is really something to see.
Do you think that that's just a coincidence, just a cycle, or do you think there might be part of it where the National League is having to keep up with the Joneses and the Dodgers raise all ships? Like, if these teams have to compete with the Dodgers and the Mets, and to a lesser extent the Phillies, and their spending has been consolidated in the National League. But as you said, like, it's not just spending that is making these teams better. The Brewers are better without spending. The Diamondbacks have had to spend. The Padres have had to spend to a certain extent. Do you think this is an element of the keeping up with the Dodgers has made the whole league better?
I definitely do, Derek. I definitely do. And like, yeah, I think if you look at the two central divisions, right? Because is the last central division to win a World Series? Would it be the Royals?
They're in New York.
Yeah, right. So, you know, they're the soft underbelly of the industry. There's no doubt. But like right now, if you look at the five NL Central teams and what they're doing, they're just so much, to be frank, like better run, right? Than the five AL. I mean, the Guardians, I actually attended the Guardians win over the Yankees last night in the Bronx. Guardians is always in the mix and they do great work. But you know, let's face it, they haven't had any playoff success since they made the World Series in 2016. And then, I mean, the Tigers are, you know, challenging the Mets for the biggest bust in the entire league. You know, and then it's just like the Royals fell on their face, and then and the White Sox are a pleasant surprise, and the Twins are a hot mess, you know, with everything that undergone there. So yeah, like I feel like in the National League, the Central boosts the league as a whole. Yeah. In the American League, the Central drags it down.
Yeah, it's funny, just a quick aside, my son and I were watching the Dodgers Diamondbacks, and my son was like, Can you take me through the teams in the 2016, and then we talked about the rosters. He's like, those were like super teams.
Yeah,
those were like players at their peak. He goes, do you don't really have a team like that anymore that like has the young players at their peak, or like emerging stars like Ramirez was, Lindor was, all that stuff. He was going through it. He's like, those are incredible teams. It's like putting together a video game team. And he goes, again, Andrew Miller on one side, Aroldis Chapman on the other. Yeah. You know, the pitching staffs. I was like, it's a great point that like there may be like those teams have been grown together to meet that moment. And, you know, now with teams and free agency and the high spending, everything, you might not have that anymore. That my question about the Dodgers being sort of the team everybody chases and that makes everybody better leads to the CBA. Is it wrong-headed then for some of the goals of the CBA to put a cap on the Dodgers when we have real example here about how their competitive nature is raising other teams?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'm so happy that all I have to do is talk about it with folks like you, and I don't have to go to those press conferences anymore, stand outside buildings, and my goodness. Yeah, I was with you for the last week of my full-time career in Jupiter.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was very memorable. Yeah, it's such a conundrum, right? Because and are you a fan of The Simpsons?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a line from an early season. Homer says, to alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you could say, like, to Shohei Ohtani, the cause of and solution to all of Major League Baseball's problems. Because think about it, like, obviously he's a once in a lifetime, if not once in a century, ball player, and so mm-hmm. talented and so dynamic, and elevates the entire sport. And, you know, I'm sure every day Rob Manfred should thank the heavens that Shohei Ohtani exists. On the other hand, you know, he gave the Dodgers this incredibly team-friendly structure. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, he'll get paid eventually. He's getting his money. But the structure has, you know, with $2 million a year current and then $68 million a year deferred, that structure is enabling the Dodgers to put together this superpower, you know, mm-hmm. and they're well-run. So they figured it out, right? And now, yeah, two straight World Series and strong favored for a third. And, you know, they can go out and get Kyle Tucker and overpay him by a ridiculous amount
yeah.
and just shrug it off when he's like, okay, you know, when he's
yeah.
like, I think the kids will call it mid, you know, like he's okay. And just,
mid
no
is
big
better
deal.
Than chopped. He's not yet chopped. He's
okay.
Mid.
Yes, yeah. He's mid. So, and like, how do the Milwaukee Brewers, who to me are just so well run, like, how can they match that? They can't, you know, yeah. like, it's just, you know, it's Milwaukee is a smaller market size than LA. I think even Bruce Meyer would concede that. So how do you figure this out? You know, I'm not sure salary cap is the answer. Like, I think the top luxury tax 110%, right? So
yeah,
I think, you know, essentially the Dodgers are for Kyle Tucker's 240, they'd be paying over $500 million, right? When you factor in the luxury tax. So does that luxury tax have to go to 200%? Like, you know, okay. do they have to pay $700 million for Kyle Tucker? Oh, and that then scare them away from signing Kyle Tucker? You know, so I'm not sure what the answer is, but I am sympathetic to Major League Baseball's concerns because I think those concerns are valid. I also feel like the way they're expressing those concerns are a little disingenuous, like putting it on the fans, like our fans want a salary cap. Well, your fans also want lower ticket prices. So
right.
you know, your fans would like free food. You know? Yeah. So
they would love to have free parking. Free parking,
yeah,
would,
free
be
parking would be great. So, you know, don't put it, just admit that, you know, first of all, like just make the case that, yeah, the league would be better with this. And second of all, yeah, I like, again, I'm a cards on the table, full disclosure person of just concede that, yeah, these would help the owners, like the help the owners franchise values and all that.
I was at least encouraged that Manfred said that at one point, that we're concerned about our franchise values.
Oh, I didn't. Okay. I'm glad he said that. I didn't know he said that.
He said the quiet part out loud once when we were in a press conference. Okay. I was like, well, at least he said that, you know?
Yeah. Like, all right. Credit to him.
Cause he's right. And you know, I mean, the Cardinals owners also said it on the record. They're like, we look around and we see what the other sports are doing. And, mm-hmm. you know, we know why ours isn't growing at mm-hmm. the rate we want to. Though still, the Padres went for $3 billion. So
and the Padres, that was really something, right? Because this is
a
team that was regarded as a small market team, and they spent like crazy, mm-hmm. and they've created the most dynamic period in the history of the San Diego Padres.
Absolutely.
And when they went to market, they got rewarded for it. So I think, you know, and the old adage, you have to spend money to make money, they certainly proved that.
Interesting. Yeah, everybody was – there was a chill that went up the spine of owners with the Twins not getting – what
right.
they hope for.
Right.
And it was like, this is an example. And then the Padres get pretty really competitive.
Yeah.
But then they're, instead of that chill kind of receding, their eyes widen. And one's like, oh, well, now we could get more if we have cost certainty. So
yeah.
I get it. I'm interested in, now that you're like not on deadline and we're not patrolling Jupiter, waiting for, morsels of news to come out through gates that are locked. but you can look at this as a fan, which was part of what informed the, or a lot of what informed the book that you wrote. Mm-hmm. From a fan's perspective and someone who knows the game well, in addition to being a fan, knows the business of it well, do you look at this as a fragile time because so much is going right for the game and they have this nuclear option of not playing the game? Does it make this a fragile time?
Oh, I think no doubt. It's funny. I still push back at the notion that I'm a fan, Derek. I feel like I'm an observer. You know, like,
oh, okay.
Right. Like it's like even like when I watch games for my press box training, I am stoic. Like I
yeah,
no expression. Even last night, like you know, Cam Schlitter got hit, lit up. Very rare, and I was like, huh, that's interesting. Like certainly not rooting one way or the other. You know, back to your major question. Yeah, I think this is a very fragile time because I think, you know, the pitch clock has been a miracle, right? Like it has really changed the whole conversation around baseball, and credit to Manfred for getting that in there, you know? So the game is, you know, and then the WBC, which I certainly was a skeptic and critic of in its early, in its formative years, huge success and really planting some important seeds for the growth of the game, even in Europe with Team Italy and all that. And for that to all be blown up, which will happen if they lose games next year, I think this is for sure a very fragile time. And like, who's going to be the adults in the room to stop that from happening? You know, are there moderates on both sides of that table can say, look, we cannot lose games. You know, we can argue just like we did, and we can delay the start of the season like we did in 2022, but we can't lose games. That would be so damaging, more damaging than franchise values.
Yeah. Can you imagine, I mean, just to circle back on the way you kind of presented it there with Shohei Ohtani, can you imagine if there is a gaping hole on his baseball card at his peak?
Yeah.
Like, say, so he's got a 50-50 season. He's got three MVPs. Say he goes out and wins another MVP, maybe the Cy Young Award this year. Mm-hmm. And then there's a gap.
Yeah. Like, I think he has four MVPs, I think.
Oh, right. So, yeah. Three.
Two and two.
Yeah. My fault. Two and two. Yes. I mean, just imagine like he could be going for this run of MVPs. He could include a Cy Young. He's at the peak of his powers. Or the other side of it, you have guys who could be polishing up their Hall of Fame careers and might be 1 year shy, you know, like what one more year could do, you know, Nolan Arenado, right? To put it locally, 400 home runs is within sight, you know. Now that's not going to probably shape his Hall of Fame. I mean, he's got a lot of other things going for him for Hall of Fame voters. But 400 home runs from a third baseman, 10 gold gloves, I mean, those are tidy numbers, and there would be this blank spot in the final year of his contract, right? Maybe he doesn't come back from it. It's just fascinating what would be lost from individual careers and from history for a lost season.
And all you have to do, Derek, is look back at 1994, right? Exhibit A. I mean, there's a case to be made that the Washington Nationals would still be the Montreal Expos today.
Great point.
Had the 1994 season concluded as it should have. So, yeah, when people talk about what Jeff Bagwell was making a run at Roger Maris that year and Tony Gwynn was making a run at 400 and you know, Tim Raines got into the Hall of Fame eventually, but people pointed out maybe if he had played, you know, maybe if there hadn't been the work stoppages in both 94 and 81, maybe he would have gotten in sooner. You know, put up some bigger counting stats. So yeah, there are huge, huge consequences when we have a stoppage in action. And Manfred has made the point repeatedly, like since he joined Major League Baseball in the late 90s, that Major League Baseball has not lost a single game. And this will be his last stand, likely, you know, his last collective bargaining as commissioner. So he needs to finish the job.
Yeah. And Don Mattingly would have a World Series ring, possibly. Not this whole
you're right.
Story.
Yeah, 94, right.
Yeah. That was a really good Yankee team.
It was.
I think what we get from this conversation is about where baseball is, the precipice, and how a CBA could push it over the ledge, and we need to all kind of work about that, is that Manfred should read your book.
I gave him a signed copy. He,
well,
And both maybe, sides maybe could... he threw it in the fireplace, but like Homer Simpson. But there is a signed copy that I have delivered to him.
Both sides could learn from.
I gave Tony a Clark a copy, but I mean that's you know.
Yeah. Well, now you have to find Bruce.
Yeah. Maybe not.
All right. Bruce shoots pretty straight. He's blunt. I welcome that. I like that. I do like that. You definitely gave me the 102nd lesson about what life after baseball writing is like. Dayton Moore asked me over this weekend. This week he's here with the Texas Rangers, and he asked me, "Do you still enjoy it?" And it's interesting because I gave a different answer, one that maybe you wouldn't. I don't know. It's a different answer than you did. I said I am still a fan of the game. I have not lost that at all.
Interesting.
I still really enjoy the game. Not, you know, don't root for teams, root for players. Don't really, but I still am really interested in the game. And as much as I know about the business and all the stuff going around, and as much as we have to focus on that, and sometimes write topics that we're like, oh, why can't this just be the game? I still love the game. You know,
that's great.
And, the strategy of it, the challenge of it, the failure of it, the how difficult it is. And I think that, you know, I think there's elements of your book that really kind of hit on that, is the game is difficult. And there are elements that are really tough. But if you pull back the challenge of it, there's something really rewarding there, either what you get from it, the lesson, or what you do because you've been challenged. And I think that theme kind of carries through your book as well, is there's going to be some hard stuff, right? But how you react and how you learn from how you reacted will be rewarding.
I appreciate that, Derek. And yeah, I approve of your takeaway. That's great. Definitely something. Look, I think at heart, and you mentioned earlier, like this, my book is kind of a parenting book. Like we've talked about, this book is kind of like a parenting book, a mental health book wrapped in baseball and softball. And just the other day, I was meeting up with a gentleman in my synagogue in New York City, and he gave gave my book to his 10-year-old son, and son finished the book, and then my friend asked his son, like, what's the lesson from this book? What's the number one lesson? And the 10-year-old said, resilience. And I'm like, yeah, that's right up there. So I think that matches what you're saying.
I like that a lot. Man, that's great. That's Ken Davidoff. He's co-author of the book, 101 Lessons from the Dugout with Harley A. Rotbart, a book that takes you through not only baseball, but baseball as a lens to larger lessons in life. Father's Day is coming up. So, you know, hey, it's a parenting book that might be a good gift for a parent and a kid to share. You know, you can find it wherever you get your books. It's available online. You can also go to a local bookstore and ask for it, and they will order it for you. You know, you can give it a look. It's a good, you know, it's a good read all at once, or you don't have to read it in order either. That's the one thing about the book. You can kind of pick and choose. If you really, if you're very interested in being a pitcher, you can start with the pitcher. Go through that. So Ken, thank you so much for this conversation, for catching up, and for showing me you're an adjunct professor. There's life after baseball writing. This is amazing.
There is, Derek, but I love that you still love your job and that you still consider yourself a fan of the game. That's awesome. So keep kicking butt. But you know, more than anything, I appreciate the platform, and I just appreciate the opportunity to catch up with you.
That's the author of 101 Lessons from the Dugout. Ken, thank you so much. This is great. It's good to see you. I hope we cross paths at some point in time. I just hope it's not pacing the sidewalk outside of Roger Dean's Stadium.
If I am next to you there, Derek, something has gone horribly wrong with my life. No offense.
No, it's fine. maybe, you know, not just for old time's sake.
I'll send you guys a pizza. How's that?
That'd be great. Those were cherished items.
Yeah.
At 3 a.m. finding something that would deliver at 3 a.m. which we didn't. As we waited, that was a wild night. The 3 a.m. night when we were told that there was drop dead deadline at midnight.
Right.
And we're still there at three because, you know, I don't know, they set their clocks back to LA time.
Yeah. February 28th, 2022. That was supposed to be my last day of work. And then I wound up working March 1st as well.
That's crazy. Wow. They did it to you. You were the reason.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Derek.
Thanks to Ken for joining me for the podcast, and congrats on his book. Again, it's 101. See, nailed it. 101 Lessons from the Dugout. You can find it wherever you get your books, just like you can find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcasts. It's part of the Constant Cardinals coverage at stltoday.com, and you can find that in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. Lots of things are happening with the Cardinals, so that means there's lots of coverage there, including a weekly update from the minors. There's recent columns from columnist Benjamin Hockman and Lynn Worthy, and of course, the day-to-day grind from Daniel Guerrero and myself. Daniel will be on the road in New York, so look for his coverage from Queens all week at stltoday.com. I will continue to be at the mic here for BPIB, which is brought to you weekly by Closets by Design of St. Louis. Again, thanks to Ken Davidoff, longtime baseball writer and co-author of the book 101 Lessons from the Dugout. Good Father's Day parent read for the best podcast in baseball. I'm baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you soon.